Good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have our full cast of characters. I see Kirk here and James and Larry. How are you guys?
Good evening.
Very good.
I was reading an article this morning posted on Reuters that I think he's the number two person in Russia. He's foreign relations minister, whatever they call it, their version of Secretary of State. And he was talking about Medvedev. I guess he's not Secretary of State. He's the second-ranking Russian. He's right under Putin. And he was talking about what the world could expect in Syria. And he, speaking to a German newspaper, he said that Saudi Arabia's offer to supply ground troops if a U.S.-led operation were mounted, in other words, if the United States also supplied ground troops, he said is a horrible idea because a ground offensive turns a war into a permanent one. Just look at what happened in Afghanistan. And yet, here he is, he's number two person in Russia, and he realizes, you know, if the United States, and the United States, by the way, has already committed ground troops, but if Saudi Arabia backs them, then what we have is a very long, permanent war. Then he went on to say, the Americans and our Arab partners must think, well, do they want a permanent war? It would be impossible to win such a war, he said to the German translator, especially in the Arab world, where everyone is fighting against everybody. What he really meant to say was in the Muslim world, where everybody is fighting against everybody. I recall reading a prophecy from a really smart individual, his name is Yahwa, that described those who would identify themselves with Ishmael. And he said that they would be wild asses of men. Their hand would be against their brother's hand would be against them, and they would live in hostility with the whole world.
Right.
I read that and said, well, isn't today's newspaper a living embodiment of what Yahweh had predicted of these people?
Absolutely.
He then went on to say, all sides must be compelled to sit down at the negotiating table instead of unleashing a new world war.
Wow.
Here's the number two person in Russia saying what we have been saying now for 2 years. But it's one thing for us to say it in 2 years. I mean, last time I checked, our organization had exactly zero members. It has a budget of exactly zero. It wields exactly zero weapons.
Yeah, we don't have a single nuclear weapon, do we?
No, we don't. We are bereft of anything that would give us any credibility or power among men.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's one thing for us to simply boldly proclaim the truth based upon what we've learned from Yahweh that this war, which he predicted would start in Syria as a direct result of American meddling and arms, would lead to the demise of Syria and to the fall of Damascus, and ultimately to America sacrificing Judea and Samaria to the Muslims, and then the Muslims flooding into Israel by the hundreds of millions, and then to a world war. And so we can read that and say, well, you know, that is what's going to happen. But then to have the number two person in Russia say, what we're doing here is going to lead to world war. I just was amazed by the candor of it all and the fact that here's a secular leader of a secular country recognizing that that's where the world is headed. I don't think there's any way to avoid it.
No. That's not a minor player.
No. The other thing that strikes me from the news, most of you are probably following, I noticed in the chat room there was some communication about Bernie Sanders. He won 60% of the vote amongst the 40% of New Hampshireites that are Democrats, mostly from the young those whose frontal lobes aren't fully developed and don't seem to have enough life experiences to exercise good judgment. And he is an avowed socialist. How hard would it be for someone to look around and say, you know, socialism does not work. Look what happened when Russia tried it. Look what happened when China tried it. Between the two, they wiped out 100 million people. This is a really bad idea.
Well, Bernie looks like a maniac, for starters, maybe a mad scientist type or something with no brain. I wondered why I got in my email today and there were like 30 emails about supporting Bernie Sanders. Matter of fact, he talked about Bernie Sanders going up against Wall Street. Ha, ha, ha. That's funny. Wow. Even if he wanted to. I mean, this is just insane. It's just
What's the thing that's insane about Bernie Sanders is his popularity. Because I'd listen to his speech after winning the Democratic primary in New Hampshire. And he's an absolute dunderhead. I mean, he is an idiot. He could say is to incite class warfare. I mean, for him, the whole world is controlled, owned, and operated by 1%. I tell you what, we ought to be cloning that 1%. We ought to be holding parades to that 1%. They are so awesome that they're generating all of the wealth. They're generating everything. And so what he wants to do is put them out of business. Now, what kind of stupid do you have to be to take that position?
Well, first of all, he'd have to be pretty stupid to think that the elite who believe in collectivism, which is what he pushes, to not understand that collectivism is nothing more than fascism and communism used to rape the masses. I mean, that's what he's saying. Enjoy being raped.
The Nazi Party was the Nationalist German Socialist Party. The USSR was the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics. China viewed themselves as a socialist country. You know, once you have accumulated more money than you can spend, and once you've reached the point that money no longer satisfies, there's only one thing that is more lucrative than money.
Power.
Absolutely. And that's the reason that socialism and fascism are extraordinarily similar, because with both, they concentrate power while allowing for private ownership.
And they do it through collectivism.
Total central control.
So one guy ends up collecting everything.
Mechanisms.
It's just nuts. And you got some madman up there really advancing the idea of collectivism, saying, hey, you know, give this to two or three people, and by the way, I hate the 1%. What? I mean, the whole thing's insane. It's just nuts. The man's a madman. He's a madman. And I couldn't believe he could be elected as dog catcher. Forget, you know, senator or president. It's hard for me to fathom, really.
Well, the only thing I can think is that the alternative is so hellacious, and Hillary Clinton...
This is almost
lesser of two evils.
Well, this is just an impossible situation, isn't it, for those people that still vote? I mean, really, it is. It just is.
Did you hear that Ted Cruz wanted to create a commercial attacking? I think it was Rubio. He wanted to attack. He's way behind the curve. It's now Kasich that he should be attacking, but he wanted to attack Rubio. It was Christie that put Rubio out of business. Christie demonstrated that Rubio is like Pinocchio. You have to pull his strings. He only has five lines. If he can present more than five talking points, you know they're going to turn him into a real boy. And so Christie exposed Rubio as nothing but a nice smile and a pretty suit that can present his five talking points no matter what the question is. But it was interesting that O'Cruz is trying to strut his credentials and as a values Christian candidate. So he he put together a commercial that had four or five people sitting around a table talking about what they didn't like about Rubio. And the woman that they had expressing the anti-Rubio, promoting the Cruz value agenda, she was a porn star.
Well, that represents Christian values almost perfectly. They're just not aware of it yet. Yeah.
She was a porn star. And then they asked Trump on the eve of his big win in New Hampshire, what do you think about torture? This was Stephanopoulos asking, what do you think about torture? And he says, we need more of it. Yeah, what we need to do is we need to torture more. And then in
torture more people.
Yeah, torture more people. Yeah, that's the way to show that you're better than your enemy. Yeah, and torture more people. And then he went on to say in his acceptance speech for the victory that we're going to build the biggest military in the world. Everybody in the world, you believe me, is going to be afraid to mess with America.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
don't we already have the biggest military in the world?
Our military is larger than every other military in the world combined.
Yeah.
Did that stop 19 Muslims for flying planes into our building?
No.
In fact, they were so non-intimidated by the military, they flew one of the planes into the Pentagon. You know, the Islamic State has grown 100-fold since America declared war on it. You have to wonder how we can present as a nation such pathetic candidates. It's if this is the best the country can offer, we're despicable.
Do you remember when you wrote the chapter on the clandestine conspirators?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
I'm sure you do. And there, you said something about disingenuous words.
It came from
words.
The letter that Shimon wrote to Shimon.
Yeah. Right. Disingenuous words used to create fabricated realities. And, you know, and you talked about, it's not just that the words are so bad, they're in fact lame. And, you know, that's what you're describing here today. You're describing a bunch of hyperbole, just a bunch of lame words used to get themselves attention. No thought that really goes into it other than how do I look, right?
Yeah.
I mean, did it sound good?
Yeah. That's all the entire purpose of the debate is who looks the best and sounds the best. This was interesting.
You know, Moshe, he wasn't the silver-tongued devil, that's for sure. And
Yahweh chose a man with a speech impediment to speak for him.
That's right.
It's not the element.
I'm astounded. I am floored. Could you imagine, you guys? Okay, now I want you to imagine this. Your children's lives are on the line. Their lives are on the line, let's say, for whatever reason. And you put four guys up on a stage or six guys up on a stage, and whoever has the cutest retort is the guy you're going to have, you know, stand there and defend your children's lives. Now, what a stupid idea that is. You know, when they took Rahm Emanuel, you know, and he left as chief of staff at the White House and decided that he should run the third largest city in the nation. Do you know what his qualification is to do that? Do you know?
He's
been a politician all of his life.
He's got a master's degree, and I want to repeat master's in ballet. I knew you'd love that. Fall out of your chair on that one. Wow.
Larry, since you like clandestine conspiracy, here is the fourth and fifth things that Yahweh said that governments do. So Yahweh made a list of what governments do. First thing they do is I'm retreating a bit just because of your mention of the clandestine conspiracy and from and from the realization that America seems to be picking up where Iowa left off in terms of government's taxing. So I've actually now retreated to something we talked about earlier today on the observations program. So this comes directly out of First Samuel. This is 1 Samuel 8, 11. And he said, this specifically will be, will come to exist. The decisions and judgments, the procedures and process of the ruler in government who shall reign over you. First, he will continually take your sons. Second, he will appoint for himself vehicles used as his weapons, as his cavalry, as a means to pierce, to separate, and to scatter. Third, then he shall move swiftly, have them move swiftly before his vehicles, which will be used as weapons of war. 1, 2, 3. I'm going to governments will draft your sons, force them into the military. They will build weapons of war for them to operate, and then they'll deploy them and fight battles. 1, 2, 3. The first three things that government does. Then number four, he said, and he will appoint for himself commanders and captains, lords and princes of thousands, and military officers and with rank and leaders of the government and society over 50s. They're going to build a whole hierarchy of people to control others, to impose their will upon others, to subjugate others. And then this is the line that I wanted to share with you, Lurk, because it's consistent with what you just said. It's a line that is cited by Shimon Kefesh. And by extension, this group of hired guns, the commanders, captains, lords, and princes, by extension, they will conceal the evil that they are doing for him while devising a plot which leaves others deaf, dumb, and speechless.
Is it significant it's in the fifth place?
Yeah, really, yeah. The
chaotic.
Yeah, number of chaos and of confusion. And so what God is saying is not only will they go to war and sacrifice your sons to go to war and dedicate the economy and raping the economy to build these weapons of war, they're never going to be honest about what they're doing. They're always going to be planning, plotting, and their actual motives they will never reveal. You know, George Bush never explained the real reason that he lied about going to war in Iraq. And, you know, 1 million people have died. The world's at the brink of world war because of that stupidity. But he never bothered.
I don't think that was really stupidity. I don't think it was stupidity. I think it's just evil. I don't believe it's stupidity.
Yeah, it was evil.
I think
it was evil. Self-serving evil.
Yes,
he did it for
there we
personal
go.
Reasons. Self-serving evil. And then it goes on with the rest of it, and the rest of it is all take, take, take. It's Bernie Sanders could have been the poster child for this. They will reap the harvest for the purpose of manufacturing his implements of war, along with the implements and apparatus to complete his military vehicles. So take from the people's productivity so that you can make weapons so that they cannot rebel against you. And with regard to your daughters, he will continually take them and make them ointment makers, working as druggists and as menial executioners and butchers, as bakers of religious cakes. And from the best of your fields and pastures for grazing, the best of your cultivated land and vineyards, the best of your olive groves, he will continually and actually take. And he will give all of these to his servants, to his designated officers and officials, to his dependents. Take from the productive, give to those that you can control, and you entrench yourself in power. Destroy the economy, destroy any hope of morality, of any incentive. But this is indeed what Bernie Mark is promoting. This is Bernieism, socialism. So your sowing of seeds and your cultivated land and vineyards, he will decimate by demanding a tax, confiscating a tenth. And he will give all of it to his high-ranking military officers, government officials, and religious ministers that he controls, and to his subjects, his slaves and servants. Wealth redistribution, entitlement mentality. Create a military and so that you cannot be rejected. You cannot be overthrown. Create a massive military and then steal from those who are productive to enrich those around you who are enforcing your will and to give to those who, through dependence, you ultimately control. The mother's milk of politics, of government. It's how it works today. Now, Yamla has to be pretty smart to explain that at this time to these people. But that, my friends, is exactly what occurred.
Yeah.
With your male and female workers, your subordinates and dependents, in addition to your best men, and with your finest beasts of burden and your most desirable oil, he will consistently take to engage in his affairs and mission. Your flocks, he will decimate by taxing, confiscating a tenth, and you shall literally and continually exist for him accordingly, therefore, as slaves. And we talked a bit about this on the observation show today, that the reality is that for most of humankind, it has been a master-slave situation. You know, that is what Rome imposed. It's what existed in Babylonia, in Assyria, in Egypt. It is the nature of humanity. It is precisely, though, what the Roman Catholic Church imposed with Theodosius, creating a feudal state with lords and serfs controlled Europe for better part of 1,000 years. And we've gone back to it today. In fact, America, of course, was founded with slaves, but we've gone back to it today through the mechanism that Yahweh has established. If you are 100% dependent on somebody, then they control you.
Well, you know, what we call freedom is obviously not freedom. It's freedom to believe you're free when you're not. But it's even that is a relatively new thing in human history, even this amount of freedom enjoyed. Now, I think it's the one thing that they really hate about the middle class is that it represents a certain amount of freedom. And you have to stratify a society, I mean, if you're really going to separate it. And, you know, in other words, separate yourself from above the unwashed masses. So you got to kind of eliminate the middle class, and that's what's going to go here in the next several years. Don't you?
You also had to eliminate the farmers. You know, when we had so many people on the farm, that makes you very independent. You have your own job, your own house, you have your own wood, your own food.
I mean, I think that Trump is dangerous because I think his policies could be extraordinarily would lack thinking, would lack thought. He is an egomaniac, so it's hard to imagine what he could impose. But with a Sanders, should he be elected? You would have a few years in America collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And it would create a dependency class, Larry. So I think that what you would end up with is because if you take on a federal level 50 to 60% of what people make, and then you take another 10 to 15% on a state level, and then you take another huge slice through through property tax and sales tax, when you're ultimately taking something in the range of 75-80% of what people are making, there's no incentive to make. There's no incentive to be productive anymore.
Yeah, and then the whole thing falls.
And the whole thing falls. Yeah, the whole thing falls.
Yeah.
Just, when there is no incentive, and then because he despises business, the only businesses that will stay in the country are those that are dependent upon government contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
You know, GE, it would have been in GE shareholders to leave. Now, GE just moved its corporate offices because of a congressman in the district where they had their corporate office voted against the import-export bank, so they moved their offices, their corporate offices. They'd moved them to another country, probably to Northern Ireland, if it wasn't for the fact that most American manufacturers are now dependent upon government military contracts. Otherwise, they'd be gone. We will eliminate American business. It'd be, there's no reason to stay here. If you can go anywhere else, you'd go someplace else. Why would you, as hard as it is to show a positive bottom line, why would you give up half or more of that to the government if the rest of the world would take 15% of it? They'd lose it all.
Is there somewhere to go for those businesses?
Well, you know, there are not a lot of great options. I mean, when God said this is what governance was going to be like, he didn't say some governance.
No.
This is all governance. So, you know, you're a little better off than Australia, a lot better off probably in New Zealand, although, you know, New Zealand has a bit of a socialist... Yeah, and New Zealand does have a little bit of a socialist twinge. You know, you're a little better off in Chile, a little better off in Costa Rica, but Costa Rica is under the blight of America's war on drugs. No, there's not a lot of places to go. You know, Ireland is, but the weather's really crappy. Canada's a little better than the United States now.
Pretty cool, though.
But, you know, the United States is going to take half of what you have when you leave.
How about Panama?
Yeah, I think Panama's come a long way. Yeah, but yeah, it's.
Are you gonna really sneak your money out of the country?
You know, I don't know what you do. We're 10 years away from the tribulation, so I guess we ought to be expecting that this is what it would be.
Yeah.
And so God says, and you will cry out in this day. Because of the concerning presence of your ruler and your government, whom you have chosen for yourselves. You know, the Germans voted for Hitler. Americans are voting for Bernie. You chose him. And when everything collapses, you're going to cry out. And what did God say? But Yahweh will not answer you in those days. You know, the deal is that if you call out to Yahweh after you've rejected governance and religion, he will absolutely answer you. But if you've chosen religion and politics over him, then he's not going to answer. He's going to say, hey, turn to the people you made your bed with.
You loved.
Yeah. Yeah, you love them. Go to them. See how it works out for you.
You trusted your government.
You trusted your government. Then this goes on to say, but the people utterly refused to listen and were defiant in the rebellion regarding what they were hearing. It's Yahweh's ultimate quid pro quo. It's why God says, never ask us to pray to him. He asked us to listen to him. They would not listen to God. They rejected what God had to say, but the people did not listen and were in defiant rebellion. So they did not listen, and so God does not listen. Now, if you want God to listen to you, listen to him first. If you listen to him, he'll listen to you. Well, part of that, too, is because if you listen to him, you're not going to be babbling nonsense. You're not going to be praying in the name of the Lord Jesus.
You're not going to be
asking for salvation.
What do you hear at the end of almost every one of these goddamn political speeches? What do you hear? What do you hear? Almost
God bless America.
Yeah, and it is just so wimp.
It's worse than wimp. It's irritating.
It's like walking through. There used to be a store. Called Kresge's. They had dime stores. There was Kresge's and Woolworths. They were on all the main streets. And one of the rules was that you got your item free if the cashier didn't thank you for shopping there. And you would go through the line, and you were getting your stuff, this woman would look up and go, "Thank you for shopping at Kresge's," just like that.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how I
tone to the voice.
Yeah, I'm here to tell. That's how I view these God bless America things at the end of these nonsensical speeches.
Yeah.
It's just pathetic. And everyone knows it's not going
to
happen.
I'm sure, though, that it was God that picked the porn star to be part of Ted Cruz's commercial. No, God works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, well, he could have done worse. He could have gotten, like a pastor from, one of these mega churches, and he's the biggest whore out there,
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of pastors endorsing him, too.
Yeah,
I'm sure he definitely just bowed up.
He was probably too embarrassed to have one of them on. That's all.
Yeah, can you imagine, though, an election in America between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders?
I can. Yeah. Yes, we are.
I'm surprised that that's
the Donald and the Bernie. Oh, my. Yeah, one is saying that the solution to America is business, and the other one's saying the solution to America is to kill business.
Anti-business,
yeah. Yeah, one is to empower business, and the other one is to
take it over by the government.
Yeah.
Well, I read sometime back here, I guess it must have been 8, 9, 10 months ago, or I don't know, maybe a year ago. It's been a while. There's so many stories out there that the French president enacted a 100% tax.
Yeah, I think 100%. I think it was 100% above
I think we did a show that day.
But it was a 100% above $1 million, and it was above $500,000. It was 75%. But just since
And they wanted to know why all these wealthy.
Well, remember, we used to have a 90% tax.
We did, during the FDR. Yeah, FDR. We had a 90% tax.
Yeah, but they wanted to. They were all worked up that wealthy people were leaving those countries.
Yeah. Oh,
what
of
did
course.
They think
that's
they were going to do.
That's what happened in America is what happened in France. They just left.
Yeah.
Yep.
Movie story.
So America, knowing that that's coming, they pass a law that says, well, you'll leave your money behind. You can go, but you're leaving your money here. What people don't recognize is that the governments, which God is talking about here, the tax and take and tax and take, that you could take it all. And the next year, you got nothing.
Yeah.
So you could take it all and distribute it, and the people that you gave it to wouldn't be satisfied, and the next year you got nothing to give. It just doesn't work. Anyway, the people said, no. Indeed, by way of branding and ownership, brother, we have actually chosen to continuously have a supreme ruler over us. Imagine this: you've gone to Shamwell. Now, Shamwell is an interesting guy. Shamwell actually met mano a mano with Yahusha. One of the seven personal meetings with Yahweh. We've got Adam had the benefit of this. Of course, Abraham had and Sarah had the benefit of it. But Samuel met directly with Yahweh in the form of Yahusha. Saw him, touched him, walked with him, ate with him, drank with him. This is a guy that that was one of those, and during his time, was the only one, that in addition to the Torah, that Yahweh provided direct revelation to. Samuel could go to Yahweh and say, Yahweh, you know, I've read the Torah, I've thought about everything you've told me in the past. This came up, and I don't have an answer for it. Could you help me with this one?
Sure, fine.
And God would say, yeah, here's the answer, and go tell the people that I gave this to you. I mean, that puts him at a pretty remarkable position. So here the people go into him and say, you know, we don't want you anymore. We certainly don't want your boys anymore. So what we're going to have now is we want a king, because we want to be just like all the Gentile nations. And so Samuel tells, you know, I think that's a really bad idea. But I'll tell you what, I'll go to Yahweh, and I'm going to get his take on this. He comes back, and he gives them 12 points as to why this is the dumbest idea you ever came up with. This is not only stupid, but by doing so, you're rejecting me. And when you reject me, I'm not even going to listen to you in the future. You're going to come crying to me, and I'm going to turn a deaf ear to you. And their response is, the hell with you. No, we don't want to be with you anymore. We don't want to listen to Samuel. We don't want to listen to you, God. We want a human ruler. In spite of everything you just told us about him, that's what we want.
See, this is one of the reasons Yah was amazed. He's amazed at that kind of stupidity. Yeah, don't you think? I mean, it's that it's just,
right.
Amazing.
That line that we considered where God said, this was our last program. He says, I can't. He was speaking of religion. He says, I can't endure it. I can't comprehend it. And I can't resolve it. I mean, the big three. Yeah, God's really smart. I mean, really, really smart. And God's saying, I cannot comprehend religion.
I think what he's saying is, I can't comprehend why people would fall for it.
Yeah.
I think
he's saying several things. One is, you can never comprehend that which is insane. You know, that which is convoluted and warped and twisted never makes sense. It's impossible to make sense out of religion. I mean, I read, I think it was two programs ago, what you have to, in a sense, believe to be a Pauline Christian. That God's admitting that he's a complete and utter failure, that everything that he has said and done had no merit, that his covenant was for naught, that his testimony can't be trusted, that he's impotent and he can't save anybody, and so that God is a total failure, went to this insane man who was demon-possessed, who was vicious, who was a sexual pervert and an egomaniac, and said, you know, I failed, but I think you can come up with a plan. I'll endorse your plan. You come up with a plan that totally contradicts and demeans everything I've said. We won't provide any proof that your plan is true, even though we'll provide overwhelming proof that mine is. And people just have to believe you, and they'll be saved.
Well, you know, I don't know about you guys. Have you ever seen, I saw a picture of Paulos,
mm-hmm.
at least the oldest one. And if he really looked anything like that rendition, there is no wonder he was, it's no wonder he was a sexual pervert. I mean, the man had no hope of ever landing a date of anything. He was just really, he looked like a, at least in the rendering I saw, which is the oldest one there is available, he looked like a crackpot maniac. For real. And I mean, these are the people that liked him that did this painting. I mean, if this is the best they could do, if it looked anything like him, wow.
So what is that, a Roman, some kind of Roman picture they found, or?
Yeah, the oldest picture they got. I'll try to find the link and put it in the chat.
You know, when we're going to, in a future program, we're going to turn to Proverbs 6, which is something we've gone over, but I've spent a lot more time on it. And a couple of things that I have found that I didn't previously know is that when God goes about introducing Paul as the villain that he is attacking, the lone individual that we should watch out for,
mm-hmm.
he said that he will be known for his travels. And so I began to think of all the people that claimed to speak for God and who actually spoke for God. They didn't move around very much. They stayed in one place. But I put together Paul's travel log, and it takes a full page just to cover it. And then it said that the thing that will distinguish him is his position on mule. Circumcision.
Circumcision.
Is the thing that is going to distinguish him.
So, yeah, did you give up on Paul?
Yep. That is the one. So, indeed, by way of branding and ownership, brother, we have actually chosen to continually have a supreme ruler, a head of state, a political, social, religious, and military authority, a sovereign, a government leader over us. Indeed. Now, directly out of Yahweh's Torah, because what they chose is they specifically said, we want a Gentile. We want to be talking to Gentile nations. So I started to see, okay, what does the Torah have to say? So we turned to Devarim 18:9. This is how it reads. Indeed, when you come into the land that beneficially, as a result of the relationship, Yahweh, your God, is literally giving to you, choose not to teach, not to accept, not to respond to, nor submit to, lo lamad. Decide that to make a habit of imparting information about, continually training others in, don't disciple in, don't speak on behalf of, do not become accustomed to, in order to act upon and engage in anything resembling or associated with the detestable and repulsive abominations, especially the confusing lies associated with idolatrous idol worship of the pagan Gentile nations. Toaba, abhorrent practices from Toa, to cause trouble by confusing, to engage in wars by lying, to mislead, mystifying, and bewildering, causing uproarious conflict and strife, from Ta'ab and Ta'ah, abominable religious rituals which are abhorrent, errant, and deceitful, intoxicating, and causing many to stagger and wander away. That is what Yahweh says about the Gentile nations. You know, every nation on earth today is Gentile, with the exception of Israel. Now, there's 250 nations in the world, 249 of them are Gentile. And God says, don't do what they do. Don't have governments like them. Don't have religions like them. Don't have customs like them. Don't have holidays like them. And yet, what has the world done?
They imitated each other. They imitate. Right. They even incorporated each other's whoredoms. They did. They absolutely do.
Well, if you look at Christianity, virtually every aspect of Christianity is from the Gentile nations, most of which were practiced in Babylon. Jesus is modeled after Dionysus, who was modeled after Isis, who was modeled after Ninus and Tammuz. All exactly the same, born and bred in Babylon. Easter and Christmas are Babylonian holidays. They're derivatives of Astarte and Ishtar. The Trinity is Babylonian. The Lord, Baal, was the chief Babylonian god. Bible means with Baal, with the Lord. You can't find an aspect, a dying and resurrecting God. Babylonian. And everything that exists within Christianity, it's Lent, for example. You know, Roman Catholics are celebrating Lent. Babylonian, weeping for Tammuz. It's churches, Babylonian. The Mass. The Eucharist, Babylonian. So, yeah, the most popular religion in the world today is Babylonian. And the second most popular, Islam, is principally a bastardization of the Babylonian Talmud. So, That is what we have created, is religions that are based on the Gentile nations. And the other thing that was interesting about the Gentile nations, they were all, the leaders of those nations were always the head of the religious sect, the national authorized official religion of the country. And they were always, they always owned the entire country. Everybody was their subject. And they were always the head of the military. So the head of economics, they owned all the land and all the means of production. They owned, controlled all of the military, and they were the head of the religion. It's what the world would model for millennia thereafter. Therefore, Yahweh says, unto the way of the pagan nations, never teach, never accept, or never submit to. For they are from the signs of the heavens. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Sorry.
Nor should you be in awe, and thus frightened, confused, and therefore dismayed, confounded, resulting in destruction, because indeed the Gentile nations are confused. They are dismayed. They are confounded and destroyed by them. So, think about the signs of the heavens. Now, virtually everything that was made its way into these Gentile religions, the Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Assyrian, the Greek, and the Roman gods, they were all displayed in the heavens, either the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, or constellations.
Constellations.
Yeah. The zodiac, in conjunction with the earth, sun, moon, planets, and solar system, served to provide what was misrepresented as gods and goddesses. You know, from the movements of these heavenly signs, divine advice was proclaimed, prophetic predictions were made, resulting mythology was used to frame all aspects of architecture and temple design, religious worship. The leaders went to these omens for insights as to when they should fight wars, military campaigns, to empower and justify cleric and king lording over the people. You know, rivals for the throne fought, and empires were expanded based upon the oracles of these gods. And the pagan calendar even revolves around them. The vernal equinox, the sun representing the Lord, crosses the constellation of Taurus, impregnating Ishtar to Ishtar on Easter Sunday, so that 9 months later the son of the sun is born during the nativity, celebrated on the winter solstice back then, December 25th. With the zodiac, rather than the sacrificial lamb of God, it's Capricorn, the goat, representing Satan, that emerged on that day. You've got Virgo, the virgin, representing Ashtart, Ishtar, Venus, and later the Christian Mary. And in consort with the sun, she is the queen of heaven, the mother of God. Libra, the scales, is the twisted replacement for the Torah. Scorpio, the scorpion, is one of the common metaphors for Satan's debilitating sting. Pisces, the fish, was usurped from astrology to serve Christians as their ichthus. Aries, the ram, and Taurus, the bull, are counterfeits for Yahweh and Yosha. The first letter in L, God, was drawn in the form, as you know, of a ram's head. Aries, most famous line. Now, this is the astrological sign of Aries. It's the line that is most associated to him. Is based on the verb at the heart of Yahweh's name, Haya. His line is, I am. Taurus, the most famous, Taurus, the bull, the most famous phrase is, I possess. In other words, Taurus is the Lord. I possess, I own. Further identifying the bull with Lord Baal.
Also, yeah, you know, we have all these connections. We have all these connections, Craig. And we sit here and we're you know, we this ties to this, that ties to that. It all makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, it really does. It all makes sense. Mm-hmm. And right. Why do you suppose it is you could show all these connections to any number of people and it means
get no response?
Yeah.
They don't want to know.
Well, it's just like the children of Israel. Yahweh told Samuel, this is what you're going to get. Here's all the connections. He went and told the people and said, we don't care. In fact, we do care. We want to reject your advice, and we want to go with all the things that you're telling us are just awful.
So what do you suppose these people saw? Did they think that they would? Are they these the ones that went to Samuel? Did they think they were going to be right under the king, and that was a move up for them? Was that it was just greed?
Did they think God was lying to them?
Well, they must not believe him at all.
Well, they all wanted to go out and imitate him.
You'd have to be scared out of your boots.
Right.
No, I mean, they wanted to imitate other nations, didn't they? I mean,
but why
really
would you
want
to do that? Look at the way they were treated in Egypt.
Yeah. If you're not on top in the other nations, you're nothing.
Well, even if you're on top, the life's miserable.
Because somebody gets you, yeah.
Well, you know, look at the amount of the history of places like Babylonia and Egypt and Assyria and Greece, where son would kill father and wife would kill husband to gain access to the throne. I mean, look at the period of time from Julius Caesar through Hadrian in Rome, and even further. But look at Claudius and Nero and Caligula.
Oh, God.
I mean, Romans every other year were killing other Romans. I mean, each of these guys came to power by killing rivals and turning legion against legion.
Mm-hmm.
And so even at the top, life wasn't worth a plug nickel. It was, you know, you live today and tomorrow you die, and living today you're paranoid. You can't do anything for fear that you're going to be killed, yeah, knocked off. And look at, I mean, they were marrying their horses.
What? Say what?
Oh,
sure.
His name,
Caligula
married his horse. He made the horse. He married his sister. He made the horse his senator.
And
brought him into the, made him the Senate at the, oh, God.
I mean, Adrian
keep your friend close and keep your food tester closer, huh?
There's no room for the wife in the bed because the horse is there.
Oh, that says a lot about Caligula, let me tell you.
But they were all, I mean, they were all that bad. You know, life at the top was miserable, and life at the bottom was miserable, and life in between was miserable. You know, what was it about these Gentile nations that the Israelites thought would be grand? You know, what is it about this election that causes anyone in their right mind to say, I'm excited, I'm going to go vote for Hillary or Bernie or Ted or the Donald?
Why are they throwing the hat in the ring? Are they that stupid?
I guess. I mean, this is what the people are picking for themselves.
It's a country of masochism. It's embrace failure. That's it. All it is.
So, and then it will be for us also that we shall be like all of the Gentile nations and the pagans. So he will make our decisions and govern us. Our supreme political, religious, military authority shall go out before us, and he may continually fight our battles, engaging in an ongoing state of war.
When did he ever fight their battles? They went out first.
Yeah, what happened is they fought his battles.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He's back here behind.
They fought his battles, Now it's occasional that there are times where the supreme leader leads the military. You know, in the case of Alexander, you know, he was I wouldn't say he was courageous. He was so egotistical. I don't think he even thought it was possible for anybody to kill him. So, you know, and you know, who knows how many times that he came close to death, and finally, malaria got him. But, and he only lived to, you know, taking that approach, only lived to 30-something. So it's not exactly like he dodged a bullet for a long period of time. But
most of Darius,
it is true that the people fight, you know, in the United States, with the hundreds of wars, very seldom did America have a leader leading the fight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after you have the Revolutionary War, can you name another time?
No.
You
know, no. You
well, Lincoln wasn't out there on the battlefield.
No.
I mean, he went to McClellan, where McClellan wouldn't attack Richmond, and made a big fuss, but he wasn't leading troops. He was trying to get his general to go off and kill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but American presidents, you know, FDR was not out in the battlefield. Oh no, he's way too valuable for that. And you know, the guys that were out, you know, it's like Eisenhower. He was not a general. He didn't storm the beaches of Normandy.
No. He was an office general.
Yeah, he was an office general.
Well, quite frankly, neither did Patton.
Despite Patton gets credit for being out front, but I don't think he was. He was well behind the line of tanks.
I don't even think he cared about his men. I think probably, you know, there's a book out there called The 21 Stars of World War II, and if there was a general that was decent, it was Bradley, Omar Bradley. And besides that, there was no famous general that was even cared about his troops, really, too much.
Yeah, I would have thought MacArthur might have made the cut because of, at least for his philosophy. And, well, he was an egomaniac, MacArthur.
Yes.
He had the philosophy that MacArthur did, that the best strategy of war was to hit the enemy where he wasn't. So his strategy, he lost the fewest men per...
And gained the most ground with the fewest lost. That's true. I mean, he was a brilliant strategist. If you looked at care for the troops, probably Omar, for his own men, it was probably Omar Bradley. But the rest of them really didn't care. I mean, it was like... Patton was a bulldog fighter, a lot like U.S. Grant. You know, you just keep throwing them at him, try to overwhelm them, no matter how many people you lose.
Yeah, I was on a cruise... not very long ago, where met the publicist for Omar Bradley, and he spoke of him as an extraordinary man, but a very caring man. But he said that the life that he lived in retirement was royalty. You know, private aircraft at his
government's
beck and call, large estates, servants for everything imaginable, and not even a clue how to do the simplest things. Like, you know, when he would need something, he would never go to a store, didn't know how to go to a store. It was always, he had servants that did everything. And so
Well, that reminds me of Albert Gore. That reminds me of, I remember when the guy was running for president, somebody said, well, then what's a gallon of milk cost? He had no idea. What's a gallon of gas cost? He had no idea. He didn't live in the real world. He lived in an ivory tower, and other people did things for him.
Yeah.
It's insane.
So then we will.
I'm not saying that I was the guy to follow, by the way. It's follow. I'm just saying these generals are so bad. That's the one that comes up being probably smelling the best. And wow, now you found out where he went, all his estates, and he was just a guy that was clueless. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, catered to. Yeah, I had no idea what it was like to live in the real world. He was catered to. It was a. American royalty, you know, a five-star general is American royalty.
Sure.
So, God is saying in the same thing that's really said in the Torah. And the people took the exact opposite view. No. God has told us we should not copy anything of the Gentile nations, and the people said, no, we want everything about the Gentile nations. We want to be just like them. And we want somebody to make our decisions for us and govern us. We want somebody to go out there and fight our battles for us. Wow.
And isn't that's what's happened, isn't it? Essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's happened. Yeah, what do
you
think?
We were talking on the morning or midday show today, Kirk, about the fact that since Yahweh can see 24 hours in the future with absolute ease, he knew that what he was telling Samuel and what Samuel was writing down and was telling the people was going to have no effect on him. In fact, it was, you know, God knew that he was going to give them a detailed answer and they were going to reject every bit of it.
Yeah.
So this exercise is strictly for our benefit.
Absolutely.
Not for theirs.
It's inconceivable that they would even record it for them because they knew going in they were going to reject it. He already knew they were going to reject it. So.
And they did.
It wasn't for them. It was for us.
It's for
us.
The
never
only reason.
I never thought Samuel.
Yeah. So for those who say this was for a different people in a different time, it doesn't apply to us. It only applies to us.
It only applies to us.
Right. It didn't apply to them. They rejected it. It only applies to those who pay attention to it.
Yeah,
because if you don't pay attention
point
to it,
of view
you reject
with,
it, then God's not going to listen to you anyway. You know,
okay.
When God says, I cannot save you from religion, you know, I don't understand religion, I can't endure religion, and I can't resolve religion. If you're going to choose religion and government, God can't help you.
Well, I thought
God's
coming in was great. God's got all the time in the world, and he won't even spend a second thinking about it.
No, he says, I can't comprehend.
I can't deal with it. Go away.
You know, I spent a year writing and then rewriting Questioning Paul. It's incomprehensible. And Paul's position is so stupid, it's incomprehensible. You finally, when you realize just how utterly inane it is to believe that God chose a man to tell the world that his plan was pornography and that his covenant was the opposite of what he said it was and that he's a complete and utter failure and can't save anybody. And yet the same God now is picking the worst of humanity, a demon-possessed egomaniac that's a sexual pervert and vicious, and he's going to come up with a plan that God's going to endorse without any proof of its validity, and all you have to do is believe it. And the plan is the antithesis of the plan that God conceived. And who in their right mind is going to buy that?
Somebody just wrote 1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to be the king, is supreme. That may well say that in a biblios, but then we're told really not to read them. So, you know, I can promise you that Shimon never said any such a thing. So the fact they attribute that to him is really pathetic. I mean,
it
just goes to show how hard copy editors work to do anything. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, I mean, it is true that that's what Paul wrote. And we have old copies of Romans. We have copies of Romans probably within 30 years of the time that it was written. So there's no question that's what Paul said. But with Shimon Kefesh's letters, we really don't have old versions of them. And so we really, all we know is that even with the books where there were old copies, sometime right around Theodosius, it didn't matter anymore. They changed everything to suit their political and religious agendas. And so if you don't have an old copy, which you're reading is just complete subjecture. Religious copy edit, so I don't spend any time.
Well, you know, Yahweh's soldier just said, Larry, I disagree. He said, Yahusha made a prophecy. Okay, great. So if I took a book, and I really want to say this, if I took a book and half of it was what was really written and then added half, which was complete bullshit, like as an example, Shimon Kefesh saying, listen to your government officials. How accurate would that book be? Because it would become a lie, wouldn't it? Didn't Yahweh tell us not to consume the words of the wild boar or any of their published material.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah, well,
and last I checked,
that, Yosha was pretty clear. You know, I think that the only book that is highly credible, to at least the degree that it's that we have some old copies of much of it, even though we don't have it in the original language. If you can convert it back to the original language, Matanya. And so that's about the only place I'm going to feel comfortable, because even though I think that Yao Kanan was devoted to conveying the truth, he was so copy edited that it's tough to glean a lot from his book. And, you know, the first 16, 17 chapters of Revelation, if you can get them out of Greek properly, have some merit. But the rest of it, I tell you, I wouldn't give it much credibility.
I wouldn't give it any credibility if they're trying. You know, if you read Second Shimon, where he talks about what the government's going to do to you, and it almost mirrors what we're reading today.
It does. Yeah, it's right, but we're
it would take somewhere. A complete ass, and apparently
right.
we have one in here, to believe that somehow he's promoting or advancing or supporting
yeah.
the idea of following governments. Because
I mean, the fact of the matter,
he says exactly the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm convinced that that for the most part that Shimon Kefish was a pretty righteous dude. I think that he made some horrible mistakes. Yosh actually refers to his being influenced by Satan right after his most important statement, and you know, and he finds himself lying to protect his own sorry rear end during the events of Pesach. So, you know, as guys go, though, I think he and Yao Kanan were pretty squared away. I think that the testimony we read from him in Acts when he's refuting Paul is pretty sound stuff, pretty stout stuff. But that said, the more I study the history of the so-called Christian New Testament, it's just horrible. And it may be at best that one word in 4 or 5 is reasonably accurate, and even then, it's been translated by a religious cleric out of the language it was originally written in.
And
the only books that
just
we know were not translated are Paul's. Paul wrote in Greek, but the rest of it wasn't written in Greek. The disciples didn't speak Greek.
Well, they don't just do that. They'll go back and say you take a word like nomos, and nomos means what? It means Torah, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Nomos is used to translate Torah throughout the Septuagint. It's almost exclusively used throughout the Septuagint to translate Torah. It's not a great word for Torah because Torah, as we know, means teaching, guidance, direction. And so nomos isn't spectacular, but there is an insight in the original meaning of nomos that has some value, which is it speaks of nourishment, which leads to an inheritance. And so by using nomos to translate Torah, you don't get the actual meaning of Torah, but you get the purpose of Torah.
Well, the point is,
when nomos is translated to law in English, and you've lost all.
There you go. There you go. So that's my whole point. They not only change words, add words, detract words, they change the very meanings of words. So you go back to their corruption. I mean, I will
right.
tell you, right now, nearly every Christian will call Torah the law. The law.
Well, of course. Sure. Or you look at the Yosha would have used the word that is translated in Greek from Hebrew. Ecclesia, there's only one Hebrew word that has an equivalent meaning to what ecclesia, which means to invite, to summon, to call out by name. The only word in Hebrew, which he was speaking Hebrew, that has a similar meaning is mikra.
And so he's saying Mikra, which speaks of his seven annual invitations to be called out and meet. It is translated Ecclesia, which just conveys a small part of that, but it's no longer a title relative to what Yahweh and Yahusha are trying to reinforce. Loses its, 99% of its meaning. And then it's changed to church, the name of a pagan goddess. And so, and why would anybody in their right mind, knowing that, rely on a book that belongs to that?
I have no idea. Why would anybody speak? Why would anybody
called?
Why would anybody be copying and pasting King James Version's passages into this chat room? I saith commandeth byeth eveth. I say you're an asseth. That's what I say you are. And why don't you get out of this chat room and go read your goddamn Bible? Matter of fact, it's not worth paper.
What did Yahweh say about a new covenant?
There isn't one. He'd never split.
He said, I will never split my covenant into two.
No.
Never. He said, I'm never going to annul the original one, and I'm never going to break the initial one, and I'm never going to divide it into two. And then,
to ask you this, because this is all over me watching this ass post this stuff. Why would anybody in this chat room be posting anything out of a King James Version book named after the sun goddess Biblia, and meaning Bebel, and with Bel? And acting as though it was somewhat accurate and trying to use that in order to advance some kind of theory in his mind. Because all he's doing is taking translations that are at best purposefully misleading and throwing them up here.
Let's pretend for a moment that that's actually what Shimon Kefesh wrote. Just pretend that's what he wrote, that you should subject yourself to kings.
Shimon, you're not my God. What's wrong with you?
When Yahweh and Samuel said, don't do this. If you subject yourself to a king, you're rejecting me.
Mm-hmm.
If you acquiesce to the ways of the Gentile, then you're rejecting me. If Shimon Kefesh wrote, you should subject yourself to a king, and Yahweh said, you should not subject yourself to a king, who would you trust?
Pick them.
Go ahead, take your pick.
I see. This was all just a joke.
Pretend for a moment that he actually wrote it. Who are you going to pick?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't care what Shimon had to say. I really wouldn't care.
I wouldn't either. I wouldn't either.
Joe, nobody.
Right. If in fact he wrote that, then you have to discard what he had to say.
That's right.
Because what he's saying is the opposite of what God said. He would be wrong.
Let me share something. I'm sorry.
Yeah, God does not change. Go ahead.
I was just going to share something with you. From time to time, I'm plowing through something, and I look through another lexicon, what have you. And Strong's is pretty Christian, right? You agree with me on that?
Strong's was created for a singular purpose,
mm-hmm.
to justify the translations of the King James.
Okay, well, let me tell you where they screwed up. Here's the Strong's, and this, if you're looking for it, is 2424. And you'll see Ahusus. And then it'll say Ahusus is Jesus, the translation of a Hebrew term, Yahweh. Yahusha, rather. And it's, and then it'll say Joshua. Of course, was the transliteration of, and then it'll say, which means Yahweh saves or Yahweh salvation. Now, if you're reading that, even if you believe Jesus is okay, it just told you what his name is. It just told you even in the Strong's.
Yeah.
So I wrote
are they wrong that Iusu?
Well, yes, all of that is wrong.
That is all wrong. And what they did not point out is that Iusun is never written out in any great Constantine manuscript ever. It's always a placeholder. And that the placeholders were also used in the Septuagint before it in exactly the same places for exactly the same reason. But in the Septuagint, they replaced the Greek placeholders with Hebrew, with the actual names written in Hebrew. And it's because you cannot write those names in Greek and convey the proper pronunciation or the proper meaning. But so Strong's was what, 10% accurate. But even with the 10% they gave, it was enough to realize that Jesus was wrong.
Yeah, so I mean, if you came to that, you would, I would say, well, wait a minute. If this is true, and I understand it has to be transliterated, not translation, why, what's something ain't right here?
Well, even just the idea,
to go jump through
if it's based upon what they have, which is correct, that it's based upon Yahusha, that was the actual.
Yeah, they write it out, Yahweh.
Yeah, that it was actually Yahusha. That Yosha is rendered Joshua. Mm-hmm. Then why in the hell is it Jesus if it's Joshua?
And I knew that.
And how
was
could it be Joshua or Jesus if there's no J in Hebrew?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So once you know a few things, but I thought it was so significant at the end. They say, and this means Yahweh. They wrote it out, Yahweh, saves, or Yahweh is salvation. So I'm going, well, if that's true, and you catch it, here's a clue.
Right.
So it would be the same. It's the same point of view, or the same type of thing when you're reading something like First Peter or Second Peter or something, when he's saying things, and you go, wait a minute, that can't be right. If you know a handful of things, you go, this can't be right.
Yeah. So and one of the challenges is that in the Hebrew text.
Mm-hmm.
While you're always translating from the Masoretic, you have an enormous amount of material from the Dead Sea Scrolls to correct the Masoretic.
Mm-hmm.
And you, beyond the Dead Sea Scrolls being able to correct the Masoretic when they err, you also have the ability to remove the corruption that is derived from the diacritical markings.
Yeah.
So the diacritical markings change the pronunciation and the meaning conveyed by the letters that Yahweh used for the words. But you can very easily remove them and just look at the letters. And look at all of the words written with the that same group of letters, and all of a sudden, now you can remove the entirety of the stain of the Masoretes and go 1,300 years older on extant material and deduce the meaning of every word so that you can come up with a very accurate, highly reliable translation of the Hebrew. You can't do that with the Greek. It's not the language that was spoken, so it's already a translation. So even if you were to dig into all the nuances of the words,
mm-hmm.
Well, you're dealing with a translation that was translated by somebody who was not there in a religious text, in a religious environment. And so you've lost an enormous amount by going from Hebrew to Greek, and then from going from Greek to English, and then you have all of the problems of the fact that, unlike the Hebrew, where they made every attempt to accurately copy the text. I mean, the number of changes, for example, in the Hebrew, if you look at the Masoretic text and the book of Yeshaya, where we have the entire thing, it's one out of every 14 words that was altered by the Masoretes, and most of the changes are fairly small.
Well,
one
and
right 13
same,
or 14.
The same
words.
Error repeated over and over, like the names
right.
And
now,
things like
now,
that.
Right.
So you eliminate that.
But even with the Masoretes, they didn't remove Yah. Well, they did in some places.
Right.
130 times they removed Yah was saying. For the most part, they just wrote Adonai above his name.
Above it, yeah.
So it's not like they removed Yahweh's name. They just wrote Adonai above his name. But
and just won't allow the name to be said. You know?
Well, to give them credit, they only changed one word in every 13 or 14. And most of that, you can undo because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. With the case of the so-called Christian New Testament, there are over 300,000 discrepancies in a document that's only 180,000 words. I mean, just think of the scope of that. You're dealing with average of two changes per word, as opposed to one change that can be undone and corrected at every 13 or 14 words. And it's just astronomical. The callousness, the carelessness that went into maintaining it.
It's a
fool's folly to try to deduce serious meaning from it, with exception, perhaps, of the words of Yosha as they were chronicled by Matanyah, because there, when you know that he was speaking Hebrew and everything he said is affirmed elsewhere in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, you can go back to the original words that he spoke and deduce the meaning.
Well, you know what I was going to say, what I did this past week, before I looked at your translations, so it wouldn't influence me, I took a standard translation. I went through everything I normally do, and I have about 7 or 8 pages on the section we did today. And then I took further another 7 pages on the other side and coded them, you know, this, so I'd know what, so I wouldn't get lost while we were talking. And not that I needed to bring all this up, it's just, but for my own sake, to know what we were talking about, if there was something else to be gleaned that I could figure out, I took all the ancient meanings plus all the ancient letters and did that on another set of about 7 pages. And I have that spread out while I'm reading yours and while we're talking. And if I can use even, I have far less material to go to than you do, but I went off more than 2 or 3 little places. And that's, I'm not bragging. I'm just saying, you know, you can find it if you dig it.
You can
spend some time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why it takes such an enormous amount of time to do this. I mean, it's, I can work for days and translate and comment on 3 passages.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like it's tedious. It isn't. It's really fun, and you're always finding extraordinary things. But it is absolutely available if you're willing to invest the time, and that's true with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Yahweh proved that the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that he inspired, and we have very, very old manuscripts of it, and he said everything so many times that we have absolute assurance on our translations and the meanings in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. That just is not the case in the Christian New Testament, beyond the fact that according to God there is no New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm looking forward to meeting Shimon Kefish. I bet he's an interesting guy. He's certainly a rascal, passionate dude. He'd be a fun guy to share a glass of wine with around a campfire. But man, if Shimon Kefish says anything that is, we read under his name something that is in conflict with what God said, then A, it was either added later by a religious individual trying to press an agenda, B, improperly translated, or C, he was wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I care. I'm not getting my inspiration from Shimon Kefish.
No.
There is nothing that Shimon Kefish said that I need to know.
That's true.
Nothing. So
but it's fun to do. I tell you, this is hard to do.
Yeah, it is.
But it's hard, and it takes some time. But I mean, it's not. But it's
fun. And the biggest challenge I have right at the moment is pertains to something like I was analyzing one of the words that Yahweh used to describe what government would do to the women. And analyzing it, I saw lots of references that caused me to say he's not saying they're going to be perfume makers, but drug makers.
Yeah.
And I didn't get. Yeah, and I went through, and that's the reason I'm bringing it up. And I went through every word that was written with the same letters to come up with that rendering. But I did not write a paragraph on saying, you know, here is how I derive that. Because a lot of the commentary is going back in and saying, you know, this is where you get that, or, you know, here's the roots of some of these words that will derive that particular meaning. And you say, you know, should I have written it? You know, and then does a chapter that's 60 pages become 90 pages? You know, and because there is, and I remember, for example, when James was doing a lot of translating, and he would write and say, how'd you get to that? And because, you know, I did write down in the commentary how every word was translated. And so, you know, I'd have to go back, look at all of the resources and go back over them. And you know, it was always there, but it is a bit, it's laborious in the sense that it takes a lot of time. And you wonder, you know, should you share every single word on how you came up with that translation?
Well, I like it, but I understand why you don't write another 10,000 pages. That's a lot.
I can see why if someone who's new comes across something that in-depth, it can be a bit daunting of a challenge.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
especially if you're writing for a
public audience,
you have to balance, you know, the in-depth with the, you know, readable.
Yeah, and that's what I find that if I augment every verb with a stem, mood, and conjugation, that it becomes overwhelming. But the ones where the conjugation, the mood, and the stem makes a significant difference in terms of our understanding, then you do it there. But I choose not to do it everywhere just because I agree you can wear people out. And where it makes sense to actually walk through here the reasons for this rendering, this translation of a word, but you can't do it with every word.
No.
Yeah, I think you wear people out. And in the commentary, I think knowing how the human mind works, I think it's important to introduce what God's going to say, frame the issue, present what he has to say, and then say, this is what this means. So you're writing the same thing three times.
Right.
But I think that's the only way that people really catch it. Otherwise, we have a tendency to read right through it. And you need to slow people down to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean? How does it relate to other things we have learned? And to some degree, if you don't introduce each statement saying this is what God is saying and this is why he's saying it, most people will read right through it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're a writer, and you do such a marvelous job. You know, I'm just looking up words just to see what it means, you know, like playing with a dictionary. But, I couldn't do what you're doing, but I can see where you're coming from. So I can guarantee that, yeah, that's right, by every source I can imagine.
Yeah, I don't think of myself as much of a writer. In fact, I've been reading the book that that Roy recommended, called the Chaos Theory, and the fellow that wrote the book, his writing is really extraordinary in terms of how colorful and depictive and vivid his portrayal of the scene is, and the way that he's communicating these ideas. And my only ability and purpose in writing really is to say this idea is deducible from these words, and this is its application in terms of our lives and how it adds to our understanding. So it's more to be just matter of fact of, okay, this is what God said, this is what it means, and And it's not that God needs somebody to explain what he means, but, you know, let me give you an example. If you read Dabadim, Dabadim is completely in Moshe's words.
Right.
And so what Yahweh realized is that he could present his case, but that the way our minds work, the way we learn, is we really need to go over those words using our own kind of thought processes, focusing on what's really important, applying it to our lives, and explaining what it means. And that is what Dabadim is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Dabadim is really commentary on the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he uses Yahweh's testimony and then he comments on it. And that's what I'm trying to do as I write. I mean, it's not, you know, Moshe's Dabadim is inspired and mine's not inspired, but it's the attempt is to do the same thing. You know, if you listen to a lot of what Yosha said, he didn't so much quote the Torah prophets and Psalms as he did explain the Torah prophets and Psalms.
Yeah. Well, he certainly put it in language we can understand.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the, you know, remember, we're still speaking in English here. So,
yes. So we automatically have
a lot of labor. I'll never look at a word the way I would if I grew up with these words, where I wouldn't even think about it. And I just know all that stuff, all that would come with it.
Yeah. Now, this, by the way, is interesting. This next statement says, then Shamuel, which means he listens to God, listened to all of the words of the people, and he conveyed their words to Yahweh. Now, you just read right through that. And to go on to the next point, okay, so, all right, big deal. And my preference there is to stop and say, whoa, wow, what does that mean? Well, you know what it means? It means that Yahweh is not omnipresent and he's not omniscient. Why would Shamuel have to convey what the people said to Yahweh if Yahweh was omnipresent?
He should already know. Yeah, he would already know.
Would already know.
Your futile exercise, yeah.
Right. So
yeah,
what that's saying is that God is not omnipresent and he is not omniscient. That's really important because now two central pillars of the Christian depiction of God are torn asunder. And it also means that Yahweh gain something from his interactions with us. It, you know, it's one of the things that Roy has been really, really good about in terms of communicating about the nature of not only chaos theory, but of our time with Yahweh. If the universe was all laid out in a plan that was all predictable, you know, if it was a Newtonian universe, which once you set it in motion, you could predict everything that was going to happen, then it would be miserable for us and for God. It'd be like Groundhog Day over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's what Roy has said is that there is a reason that God does not know how it's all going to play out and has chosen not to experience the way it's all going to play out because he wants to experience it play out with us.
True. Yeah.
Makes sense.
And he doesn't want to know exactly what's going to occur. He wants to be surprised because that's what makes relationships and experiences and voyages of discovery interesting. If you knew it was around every bend, why even go there?
Mm-hmm. No, his point is well taken. Yeah, of course. Makes perfect sense.
So how God is not all-knowing. He's not omniscient.
Yeah.
There's tons of things he has not seen.
There's people he don't.
That's
yeah.
Correct.
And you don't want to know. And the more I'm reading, the less I want to know him either.
Yeah.
I'm getting.
There would be no reason for Yahweh to listen to the children of Israel. They rejected him.
Yeah.
But there is
that's
a reason
right. You
that
know,
you would listen to Shamwell.
He wants to come back. I mean, you know, and what? No thanks.
Yeah, I actually see this as because what follows is Yahweh is confiding in Shamwell.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Yahweh says, you know, I created man for companionship, and this is the only man I can talk to, and I'm really frustrated over all this. So, Shamwell, I'm going to bend your ear a bit. I just want you to listen as a friend. And I think when Shamwell went to Yahweh and said everything the people had said, I think that's Yahweh saying, you know, Shamwell, I realize I'm the only person you can talk to. And I'm going to listen as a friend. And I'm going to support you as a friend.
Wow.
Tell me what's on your
what
mind.
Concept, huh?
That's
not on your knees stuff. That's walking with your friend.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Walking with your friend. You know,
yeah,
I...
That's very touching. That's very touching,
yeah.
And it's true. I think you're absolutely
yeah.
Right.
I experience it. I think we all experience it.
Mm-hmm.
Not
well,
to the
it
level,
comes back
but Shamwell experience it.
Of Yahweh as a father,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
As an adult, I'll still call up my dad and sit there and talk to him for hours about what's going on in my life just to kind of help try and figure things out just because I know I can and I know he'll listen.
Right. Yeah, I do it with my sons all the time. So that's what's happening between Shamwell and Yahweh. They were two kindred spirits, father-son. They were best friends. And there were so few... In fact, at this time, Shamwell was the only person that God could talk to, that understood him, that appreciated him. And my sense is the only person that Shamwell knew that he could talk to was Yahweh.
Well, obviously it wasn't his sons. They had,
yeah, and we really don't know how bad his sons were. All we knew is that his sons took were remunerated, they were paid.
Mm-hmm.
And
judges
and again, God didn't like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at overall badness,
yeah, that's
I would
not a big scale.
Yeah.
No.
Right. No, it's not.
But still,
it's
disappointing. It's still very disappointing for him.
Disappointing
for his son because he was such a straight arrow.
Yeah, but again. I don't have any reason to think that Shamwell didn't still love his boys and have a decent relationship with them. When you read the attitude that the elders came to Shamwell to denounce his sons and then to denounce him, you get a sense that okay, so the boys did accept
money. Maybe exaggerated a little.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, okay, so Shamwell, from what we read, was one straight-up dude. There aren't a lot of them. No, look at Moshe. Moshe had lots of flaws. Dode had gazillions of flaws. You know, we don't know so much about Noah's flaws, but I'm sure they were there. You know, it's... I just don't think God is nearly as preoccupied with bad behavior. You know, the reason that the boys were denounced is because they were positioned to convey Yahweh's Torah, and they compromised on that mission by accepting money for it, and that's pretty serious stuff. But overall, bad behavior, I don't think, bothers God nearly as much as we think it does.
He's more interested in your mindset.
Sure.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Are you right with him? Yeah. So if you're right with him, then you know he wants to have a conversation with you. He wants to know you. He wants to... do everything he can to empower and uplift him. Matter of fact, almost everything that was in that list of things that the government was going to do, the leader was going to do, take, well, yeah, it was give.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't take anything. You know, it's every aspect of that. You know, the taxation, taking people's money. Well, no, God enriches.
Yeah, he enriches you.
Right.
Enriches all of us.
Making people's sons. No, he gave his son so that we could become his sons.
So we don't have to give our sons.
That's right. You know, rather than, you know, taxing, he enriches. Rather than taking our productivity, he makes us more productive. Rather than subjecting us as slaves, he liberates us. Rather than demoting us under this dramatic hierarchy, this huge hierarchy of officials, he brings us right into his presence, standing right alongside us, sitting down right beside him. You know, every bit of it.
What an incredible thing.
Every bit of it. He is doing the antithesis. Rather than scheming in the dark, I mean, Yahweh could plot all day long. I mean, we'd have no idea what Yahweh's mindset was, but Yahweh's idea is, no, I'm just going to tell you right up front. Here's who I am. This is what I'm offering.
No pun intended.
I'm going to tell you exactly who I am and exactly what I'm offering, and I'm going to tell it to you in full light of day. So, you know, it's the God's position and man's are exactly the opposite. All right, amigos.
One quick question.
Sure.
Before you go. Mm-hmm. Jacob's ladder.
Yeah.
Rabbi Sheesh 28:12, you and Roy's conversation.
Yeah.
Did you discover anything special on that? I looked up all the words.
The thing that I wish was that it. I wish that that it was presented as seven rungs, because then what you would have a direct affirmation of seven dimensions. That the universe is six dimensional and that Yahweh is in the seventh dimension. And so I wish that it was presented with seven rungs. Now, I know that there are seven rungs on that ladder, and you know there's seven rungs on the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
But the only two mentions of a seventh heaven, if you will, one is in the book of Enoch, and the other is with Paul as the going to the seventh heaven. So you're mm-hmm. over two there. But, you know, Satan's been in and out of heaven, so he knows all about it, because in the Hadith, there are scores of mentions of what's in each of the heavens and of seven heavens. Hasatan, Satan, is very familiar with the concept. So, I think there's only one heaven,
right,
in terms of the spiritual realm of God. I am quite certain that his Malach and Yahweh set apart spirit are in all seven dimensions.
Yeah.
And so any place where God is could be equated with the spiritual realm. I am more and more convinced that the universe has six dimensions and Yahweh's in the seventh.
Mm-hmm.
I think Roy is right in that a seven-dimensional, if Yahweh is in fact seven dimensions, then Yahweh cannot enter, cannot see, do anything in an eighth dimension. If he is seven-dimensional, then all he can do is he can act in the seventh dimension, but he can create in the seventh dimension, but in terms of conceiving something like a universe, he has to be doing that in one less dimension than he's in. It's just like with Walt Disney. He can, as a three-dimensional construct, create Disneyland, which is a three-dimensional construct.
Right.
But for him to, but that's, you know, sort of using, repurposing existing materials. But he can create a new world, if you will, in two dimensions with Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and all of the cartoon characters. And he can create an entirely new world in two dimensions. Extremely easy for him to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of Yahweh. I think Yahweh can operate, obviously, in the seventh dimension, but his creative work, the universe, is only six dimensions.
Wow,
and that's just my view. And my view right now is that that the three dimensional realm that we understand, that it is actually expanding into the fourth, which is time.
Mm-hmm.
And so three dimensions are expanding into the fourth, which is time. But that dimension is not the end, because there's a fifth and sixth dimension. So I think that's what the dark matter and dark energy represent, that one's repulsive, one is attractive. And I think that the fourth dimension is expanding into the fifth, and the fifth is expanding into the sixth. And if you think for a moment that if the universe that Yahweh creates, the new one that we will go off and explore with him when we get to spend time with him in the seventh dimension, and then go off and explore a universe in six dimensions, that Yahweh is limited because he is only seven dimensions. Just think of realize that to go from one to two dimensions is an infinite difference.
Oh, yeah.
To go from two to three is an infinite difference. From three to four, the difference is infinite. You know, and then so you're infinite times infinite times infinite, you know, all the way up through six. It's mind-boggling. You know, you look at the size of this universe, we can't even travel all around this one ball that's revolving in one tiny solar system that's a minuscule part of one galaxy that's a minuscule part of the universe. And we can hardly even maneuver around this little ball.
Mm-hmm.
And think of the 3D universe and how enormous it is. And then to realize that the fourth dimension is infinitely bigger than what we see in this universe.
But now
fifth dimension is infinitely bigger again.
If he's in the seventh dimension, he can't create in the seventh dimension? How would he create the new world?
He can, but not in the same sense of creating an entire universe and life and all of that sort of thing. If you're, you know, it takes very little of you to conceive something that is new in a lesser dimension. It is he can operate and create and, you know, and do and experience in the seventh dimension. But so much like what we do as individuals, you know, we can think, we can ponder, we can repurpose existing kinds of things, but we can't create a new universe. And we can't create something that does not exist. And
can build
in three dimensions.
We can't create a tree.
I understand. Yeah, I'll get that.
Right.
Can we be another dimension beyond
right.
that?
Can't, we can't create a tree. That's a great example. Mm-hmm. We can't create life.
Right.
We can manipulate life. We can manipulate trees. We can cut down trees. We can burn trees. We can plant trees. We can't create a tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can build airplanes, but they're all built out of existing materials. We can't create those materials.
I teach my students about the same thing. I say, you're not drawing a nose. All you're drawing is these shapes, and you can make it look like a nose. It's just an illusion, you know.
Right.
And then they kind of get it.
Yeah, and you're using pigments that are earth-born pigments
dirt,
to do that.
Dirt with hair on a stick, you know.
Dirt with hair on a stick.
And it's a pretty good trick, don't get me wrong, but
it's good stuff, and it's pretty. But the things that are in the for Yahweh to create something that out of nothing that did not previously exist, I think it is a much more reasonable process in one less dimension.
Hmm. Interesting, Tom.
So my sense is we will commune with him in the seven dimensions. We will have all of the capabilities of being seven dimensional, but we will explore within the six and then come back to share
and to party in the seventh.
Well, it's still pretty cool. So the new universe, he'll make it in the sixth dimension, or he'll make it in the seventh dimension?
I think so. I think he'll be six dimensions again.
Okay.
Yeah, I think. But, you know, he can make as many of them as he wants in six dimensions.
Yeah.
Could have if over an infinite amount of time, even though seven dimensions to explore is infinite, greater than we can't even imagine exploring.
I know. I'm not sitting here trying to imagine.
A course of billions and billions and billions of years, I can't even imagine really exploring existing three-dimensional universe. Realizing that this one's expanding into time, which is the fourth dimension, and then expanding infinitely more into the fifth, into the sixth dimension. He could create an infinite number of six-dimensional realms. We could all have our own six-dimensional universe.
I'm worried.
I heard you say that. That's pretty mind-blowing.
How he converts us from three-dimensional to seven-dimensional.
Going
over to JB's house might be an entirely different universe.
That's the bags with a lot of extra stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Don't be around.
Yeah. My ambitions for travel and exploration with Yawa in the universe. I'm really have a very passive view towards it, and what I've been looking forward is just going along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm naturally prone to be expressive, mm-hmm. to ask lots of questions and to spout lots of conjecture from what's being experienced. So I think I'll be an active conversationalist, but I really want to go along for the ride. I think it would be happy to be shown.
Sure.
And if I don't have it in my own universe, I'd much rather enjoy yours.
Well, once you create your own, you kind of know what's in there. I mean, other than showing it off, it'd probably be more fun to go visit everybody else's.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any interest in showing off. I really have a lot more interest in communing, enjoying. There's a lot of what Yahweh has to say about the seventh is restful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thrilled to be. I find being active, going places, restful. I just want to enjoy the ride. I think that's, maybe there'll come a time where you say, all right, let's be inventive. Let's go see if we can one up the platypus.
That poor thing. You give it such a hard time.
Out of all
that is one confused animal.
All righty, guys.
All right. Good night.
Put it immensely.
Talk to you guys next time. Right.
Okay, good me and Larry, where are you at?
Bye-bye. Yeah, I think Larry cut off a while ago.
Okay.
Yeah, his phone broke out on him.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom.
Yeah, Shabbat Shalom. Good night.
Night.